This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Coffee. Some like it black. Some like it with cream and sugar. Some open a can, pour some grounds into their Mr. Coffee Maker, and drink it by the gallon. Others take their time choosing the perfect blend of beans, burr grind it just before brewing it, and then use a French press or expensive high-tech coffee maker to bring out the flavor and aroma. Coffee is the world's favorite drink, and if you're among those who love the taste, we're going to explore how you can achieve that taste every time, or improve the taste, using some of the information you'll glean from the show today, and perhaps trying out some brewing methods of which you may not yet be aware. The secrets of good coffee will be spilled today on this program, and aside from being the best part of waking up and good to the last drop, today only this program will taste as good as it smells.
Oh, God.
How many more coffee slogans can I put in here? Peter Reinhardt, our chef. And by the way, this show does smell from time to time. Peter Reinhardt, our chef on assignment at Johnson & Wales University, has brewed up this program and blended our guests with his own deep roasted expertise.
How many cups of coffee have you had this morning?
Only one so far. And those guests are James Yoder, owner and founder of Not Just Coffee in the 7th Street Public Market, which is gaining a reputation as serving the best coffee in town. In fact, we're going to play a little piece that Peter and I recorded last week there. And while we were there, I ran into a friend of mine who once a month takes the train from wherever the end of the line is. He lives in Fort Mill, just to have a cup of coffee at your place and then takes the train back.
Yeah, I think him and his son, right? Yeah. That was his son,
exactly,
yeah.
Right.
They come up and I think they drink the most coffee of any of our customers in one shot. And they go through like 10 beverages.
Well, that's good. And we welcome back David Haddock. He's the director of coffee at Boquette Mountain Coffee Roasters in Noda. As the director of coffee, does the coffee do what you tell it to do?
Pretty much every time.
Well, good. Glad to hear it. Welcome back. Let me begin with the two coffee people we have at the table. What brought both of you to such an intense interest in coffee? And I'll begin with James.
I spent about a year out in Portland right after I got married about 10 years ago, and that was sort of my introduction to craft coffee scene. And that's where Stumptown Coffee comes out of. And then more recently, I spent about 3 years in Italy, and I kind of fell in love with the culture that surrounded the coffee. I'd never worked in coffee before then.
And what do you mean by culture that surrounds the coffee? Because in Italy, it seems to me, you walk into one of those coffee shops, and inevitably you ask for an espresso.
Right.
And they make the espresso, you down it, you get out.
Mm-hmm.
That's not like Starbucks. It's not like lingering with your computer.
Right. It's definitely not like a set up your laptop and hang out type of vibe. But I think what I really liked is, like, the town we lived in, you know, in the winter in the piazza, you would see 100 people out in the piazza walking around. It was cold. They'd stroll into the cafe that was there in the piazza, and everyone knew each other. And even if it was just for a minute, they'd step in, have their cafe, and be out. But there was still this sort of, like, camaraderie and this kind of cool vibe around it. And it was so entrenched in their culture that that's what I liked.
David, what about you? What attracted you to this? Because you've devoted your adult life to this.
I was in the Navy during the first Gulf War.
Where they serve great coffee, I'm sure.
Yes, yes. You can explore the depths of how bad it is.
That's where the need for roasting good coffee came from.
Exactly. Before that, I spent some time on Coronado, and there was a lovely little coffee shop overlooking the bay in San Diego. And when I went off to the war, I was making coffee on the ship, and the captain developed an affinity for the coffee that I was making. My sister was sending me coffee from San Diego. And the mail runs were always the most popular time of the day. So we would make coffee, and I just started developing an interest in it. I worked for Counterculture. I've owned coffee shops. And like you said, my entire adult life pretty much has been about coffee.
Because it's your coffee that, Peter, I read an article you wrote. I forgot the name of the magazine you wrote it in. But you talked about the little coffee shop over in the design center.
Oh, yeah, right.
And where you...
Java Passage, that's where David and I first met.
Yes, and where you tasted, I guess it was a cup of espresso that you made for him. Is that right?
It was an espresso or a cappuccino.
It was a cappuccino.
Yes. And you said it was the best. It was an aha experience.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I've had a few coffee. I don't drink a lot of coffee compared to some people, but when I drink it, I want to have a great cup.
Right.
And I've had only a couple of times in my life where it was like conversation stopping. And one was in Philadelphia at a place called Colombe. It's a great roaster up in the Philadelphia area. And that was like, wow. And then I hadn't had anything quite like that until one day I had a cup of David's and I had that deja vu experience.
I want to hear from all three of you on this. What's going on here? Because we've grown up in America on coffee. usually coming from – I'm an old person, so it used to come from a can. Pre-ground, it was ground in – if you were living in 1955, that can of coffee was ground in 1947. And it had been sitting on the grocery store shelf since 1948. And we just opened it and put it in the percolator, dumped it in, put some water in it, and drank it and thought nothing of it. You know, so we had Maxwell House, we had Folgers, we had – excuse me, Senka. and no one batted an eye. And when you go to a coffee shop or a diner, you'd pay 25 cents for a cup of coffee. People think nothing now of going in and paying $4, $5, $6 for a cup of coffee. And that has to be the perfect cup of coffee. What has happened to take us from the point where coffee was just sludge in a mug to where it has to be something really extraordinary?
I think it's an awareness of – and this is also – and Peter could probably testify to this as well. You know, just an awareness of how good food can be and how flavors are so important. Now, back when I was even growing up, you know, flavor wasn't a big deal. You know, the sludge that was on the table at night was kind of like, whatever, it's mashed potatoes. But in coffee, I've seen in the past 20 years just an explosion of interest as far as – freshness and variety and place.
I'm glad you brought that up because my mother and my grandmother thought nothing of making a pot of coffee and letting it sit there all day. And at 5 o'clock or at dinner time, if there was still some left, they'd pour a cup of coffee and they'd have it. Mm-hmm. And right now, that is just revolting to me to think about doing that. Freshness has become important. You don't keep the pot on the warmer all day long and drink it.
No. We say at Bocata Mountain Coffee, and we tell this to customers, you know, freshness covers a lot of sins.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a really freshly roasted, you know, within 10 days of the roast, a cup of coffee in front of you, you're going to have a really great experience. And I think that's what it comes back to, the experience and the flavor.
So people who still buy the major brands, and we don't want to disparage those brands, because if you like them, you like them. But what are they missing by not venturing out, by not taking the next several steps up?
I think it's also like a revisiting just across the board in the food culture. Like it's this revisiting to, like David had said, like a freshness and the interesting flavors. I mean, there's a standard idea of what coffee tastes like.
Mm-hmm.
But when you kind of delve into the world of coffee a little deeper, you find that there's this vastness to it, like wine. You know, you can get a cup of coffee that tastes like blueberry pie. And that was like my awakening moment was when I met with Brent Hall at Counterculture, and he did a pour over for me, and I had a cup of sun-dried Ethiopian coffee, and I was like, I've never had coffee that tasted like fruit and berries.
But if coffee tastes like fruit and berries, it doesn't taste like coffee. So that's going to be confusing to some
mm-hmm.
people, isn't it?
And I think it's just a change in our mentality of what coffee tastes like. Like for years, we've associated coffee tasting like
milk and sugar.
milk and sugar or stale.
Exactly right.
Right.
And put some coffee with that milk.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, and I think this is very analogous to what we've seen happen, and we've discussed on other shows
yeah.
in the world of beer making, wine making, cheese making. It's all about the nuance now, and that's where the American palate has evolved in the last over 40 years or so, but really dramatically. Even in the 5 years since we did our last coffee show with David, things have changed. The palate has changed. The Charlotte palate mm-hmm. has certainly changed and evolved and grown to begin to appreciate these subtle nuances and depths and complexities. And that just deepens our appreciation of it. And that's where guys like David and James come along to fill that, you know, that growing awareness. And then we become like wine geeks. We become coffee geeks.
Yeah. We're going to go into some depth here about all the variables that go into coffee and what makes a good cup of coffee. But let's just skim the surface at the moment. What does make a good cup of coffee? What are the elements?
Great green beans and a great roaster and a great brewing technique, I would say, are probably definitely
absolutely
core.
Yeah, I agree. The where the coffee comes from, you have to have a knowledge of sourcing, of being with the people down in origin countries to understand what they're going through and how they're producing their crop. Then that roaster, that person, brings that coffee to the United States and roasts it up at a certain way, a consistency.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a blending of art and science to make it a consistently great thing. Then, like James said, the brewing part is probably one of the most important parts because that's the seconds that you have right before you send it to your customer or you pass it across the table to your mom.
Mm-hmm.
My mom had a cup of Costa Rica that I brewed for her at my house when she was visiting, and now all I can do is pick up the phone, send me some more coffee, send me some more coffee. She just got addicted to it, and she loves it. But it's a lot of technique and a lot of understanding.
The brewing technique is so critical because, you know, with all the work that it's taken just to get the beans to you, mm-hmm. it's a miracle even mm-hmm. that you know, we get the beans after all it has to go through. Most people don't think about that. And then you could screw it up at the end by not brewing it. I watched at Deborah that the time that we had this great cappuccino at Java Passage, Deborah, who's the barista and owner there, mm-hmm. she made a cup of espresso first. And she threw it out before she even put the cappuccino together. I said, "Why'd you do that?" She said, "It took too long to come through the unit. It's supposed to come through in X number of seconds. David can tell us what those should be." And she said, "And it was like 5 seconds over. And I don't want you to experience it if it's not perfect." And
wow.
I mean, wow, he's right.
Wow. It strikes me as we sit here talking about this, and the fact that we've recorded two segments, which we'll hear later on in the program with both of you in your different locations, about the things that you do to make coffee great. That we've gone from opening a can of coffee and being happy with it, or putting those granules of instant coffee in a cup and pouring hot water over and being happy, to the point where we want to get our own beans and grind our own beans. Will there come a day when we want to get our own green beans and roast our own green beans and grind them and drink that coffee right then and there on the spot?
In certain circles, it's already here.
It's
already happening.
There are people that are using popcorn air poppers to roast their beans.
Wow.
Actually, two of my baristas, Kelsey and Tanner, both roast at home, and they use popcorn poppers. I mean, it's pretty rudimentary, but, you know, they're depending on the length of the extension cord will kind of, you know, I don't really know much about roasting, but yeah. And they've brought in some really, really good really good coffee.
You know, we've reached a point, and maybe it's on the decline now, but we got to a point where there was a coffee shop on every corner or around every corner, and most of them were major chains, and there were a few hangarounds like Dilworth Coffee, which mm-hmm. has been around forever, and they hung on during that barrage of Starbucks Caribou openings. And you're coming in at the tail end of this. As Caribou is scaling back, you open your coffee shop, Not Just Coffee, down the street here, and you have one, I believe.
South End. Atherton Mill Market.
Is there not a danger to opening a coffee shop? I mean, what sets you apart? How did you know people would find you, like you better than Starbucks?
I mean, there's definitely a danger of anytime you open your own business and are an entrepreneur. I mean, there's always that risk. But I felt really passionately about putting out coffee that was amazing and delicious, and I figured, you know, that there has to be a market for it because people are clamoring for good food, good drinks, and that seems to be the one hole in the food scene that just is missed. You can go to a fine dining restaurant, pay $200 for a meal, and you'll get the best wine, the best food, and then at the end you'll get, you know, pretty lame cup of coffee. At least traditionally that's what it's been like. And now there's restaurants like Empire State South in Atlanta that are putting out amazing coffee programs. And I'm sure here in Charlotte there might be a few. I mean, you said Emeralds is now using you guys. And so it's, you know, we're seeing that change.
And I think that what you touched on earlier, pardon me, about the camaraderie and, I mean, what you're creating in your little coffee nook there, mm-hmm. it's a cafe, it's part of a larger market, is a gathering place.
Right.
It's what sometimes it's called the third place.
Right.
And 7th Street Market, for instance, was designed as an incubator for mm-hmm. small businesses. So when James started out, it was a great opportunity to come in at not the same kind of overhead and cost that you might do with a Starbucks, and he was able to establish a place, and people have embraced it.
We're talking coffee. Community. We're talking coffee this morning. We're highly caffeinated, so you'll have to forgive if it goes by really quickly. It's because we're highly caffeinated. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
And you're listening to Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio. Where support today comes from WFAE members and Audi of Charlotte, presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction. East Independence Boulevard inside the 485 Beltway, Audi, Truth and Engineering. Information at audiofcharlotte.com. And U.S. Airways, which begins new seasonal daily service from Charlotte to Barcelona, Brussels, Lisbon, and Manchester this spring. More information at usairways.com. We meet two of the leading authorities on HIV, find out about North Carolina research that is setting a global standard, and meet a man living with HIV/AIDS when Charlotte Talks. Monday morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. Sunny today in Charlotte, a high around 52 degrees. Tonight, clear skies, cold, with the lows in the mid-20s.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, for two generations, chemical companies near Toms River in New Jersey dump toxic waste. From the Environmental Outlook archives, the life of a small town ravaged by industrial pollution.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show coming up at 10 o'clock here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio.
Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE.
Way down among Brazilians, coffee beans grow by the billions, so they've got to find those extra cups to fill. They've got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil. You can't get cherry soda, cause they've got to sell their quota. And the way things are, I guess they never will. They've got an awful lot of coffee in Brazil.
I will use any excuse in the world to play Rosemary Clooney. I just will. We're talking about coffee today. Peter Reinhart's here, our chef on assignment. Johnson & Wales University. James Yoder is owner and founder of Not Just Coffee at the 7th Street Market and also in Atherton Mill in Southend. And David Haddock is director of coffee at Boquete Mountain Coffee Roasters, which is quickly making a name for itself. We've referred to the best cup of coffee. It's a very broad statement because good coffee means different things to different people, and we tasted, and we're going to hear our tasting with you a little while from now, David. We tasted a bunch of different kinds of coffee, and they all have their own different flavor profile. So what makes the best cup of coffee? What makes a good cup of coffee? How can you determine that? It's like the difference between Cabernet and, I don't know,
Pinot.
Malbec.
Yeah, there's so many variables. We've already covered freshness. We've talked about the sourcing.
So it's just what you like the most?
It's a very subjective thing. My father, up until his death, would drink Folgers Instant. Couldn't take anything that I ever gave him. He would just pull out the Folgers Instant, make a cup, put some sugar in it, and off he goes. He loved it every day. Arr. Yeah, every single day. I knew some chiefs in the Navy that had this, you know, the big old cup, you know, right? And they'd walk around the ship, and it was just crusty with brown residue, and they loved it just simply because it.
Don't even use the word flavor nuance to people like that.
Exactly.
My screen is drawing very slowly here, and I was going to bring up an email that people wrote in about the various different methods of brewing coffee, because that plays a big role in what the end product is going to be like. Susan on Facebook says, what is considered the best method for preparing a good cup? Chemex, French press, or another method?
Again, it's subjective. We have a Chemex right here. Right. We've got a V60. We've got the siphon pot. I think different coffees bring out different coffees come out better depending on the type of brewing method you use. Some coffees work better in a Chemex as opposed to a V60.
How do you know? How would the average person know what to do?
Tasting. Just tasting and finding your preference. And each brewing method will bring out different things in that coffee.
You have a brewing method over here that I've never seen before. It looks like a chemical experiment.
Looks like something out of Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
And just as potent. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that's a siphon pot or a vacuum pot.
Uh-huh.
And it's a pretty neat device.
When I saw this in operation Not Just Coffee, I thought, wow, this is so cool. And then I went home and I went, wait a minute, isn't this the same as the old percolator method, just in glass and fancier, or is it different?
It is slightly different, but the mechanics behind it are very similar, and it's a beautiful device, so there's definitely like an aesthetic quality to it. But you have a couple things going on. You have the coffee brewing in the top and where it's like percolating, and then it has a drawdown when the bottom globe cools. So it's doing like, you know, two very different things to the coffee.
Is it bringing the water through the coffee in two directions then?
Well, it percolates up top, and then when you remove it from the heat source, as the bottom globe cools, it draws it back down, so it creates
let's
that.
Let's talk about that. I'm glad you brought that up, because everybody used to percolate their coffee. Every house had a coffee percolator, and I was reading about coffee yesterday on the internet, and I ran into this comment from somebody, and you know people make comments on the internet all the time, sometimes not terribly favorable. I've read them about me. Percolated coffee tastes better, they say, than any of that newfangled coffee makers of today can possibly make. We paid $1.98 for a whole can of Maxwell House in the 60s. It was delicious percolated coffee. Today's young generation is stupid enough to pay $4 for a cup of coffee at Starbucks. Really stupid. You kids go broke while Starbucks is getting rich. So let's talk about percolation. Let's leave Starbucks out
of this. I
love
the passion.
Yeah. That was a vehement email there.
Let's talk about percolation. What happened to coffee percolators? Was that not a good method for making coffee?
It's probably one of the worst methods.
Why?
Because you're coffee has to be extracted at a certain temperature, around 200 degrees. And it has to come into contact with water for a certain amount of time. The problem with percolators is they were literally boiling. They were coming up through the inner tube and washing over the coffee constantly. Okay, and depending on depending on who was making it. Like I grew up on a Corningware percolator and mastered it with Maxwell House. Right,
yeah.
My father loved it, and but it just continuously over extracts the coffee. You're taking out. There's only a certain amount of coffee or extraction in coffee that has to be done. 12% basically. You can extract physically 36% of everything soluble in water from coffee, and that includes tannins and nasty things that you don't really want to take. Yeah, exactly.
So it's kind of like the difference between extra virgin olive oil and then the last pressing of the olive oil.
Yes, exactly, because you can really extract some pretty unfavorable tastes out of coffee if you really try.
I ran into a new method over at Not Just Coffee, and Peter and I were over there last week. It's a new method for making a great cup of coffee, and we walked down the street, Peter and I, from the studio, and we poured over this new process. Peter, you've taken us to the 7th Street Public Market and to Not Just Coffee, and this coffee shop is evidently setting the city on fire.
Yeah, this has really become the hot spot for high-quality crafted coffee making. Coffee is now like beer. It's on a new level, and we're watching them make something called pour-over coffee, which is all the rage in coffee, and they do it the best. And I want to let Kelsey show you and tell you why.
Kelsey Viscount is making pour-over coffee. You've just ground the beans, right?
Yeah, so we dose beans to order, and then we are going to brew by the cup. So basically, this is a form of manual drip brewing, wherein we're controlling as many variables as possible.
I mean, before you even put the water in there, you set a timer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's necessary in order to get the recipe correct for each of these coffees that we keep a close eye on the time as well as the weight. So you can see down here on the scale that I've pre-weighed out the coffee, I've pre-wet the filter, and then I'm going to add 400 grams of water at sort of a steady pace based on the time I'm seeing here on this timer.
So you very slowly poured a little bit of water over the grounds and let it drip through, and now you're about to pour a little bit more water over the grounds. Why?
Right, so this is called the bloom. It's the original degassing process that the beans go through when we're brewing them this way. And what we're allowing to happen there is the CO2 to escape from the beans after we've gone ahead and ground some. And then now we're going to slowly incorporate water in a cyclical motion about the size of a quarter so that what it's doing is evenly accessing all the grounds in this filter.
And as a coffee drinker, which I am, why do I care?
Why do you care? It affects taste. So the idea here is that I'm using water at a particular temperature. I'm using beans that have been ground a particular way. As you see how I'm pouring this in a certain direction, all of these things are going to affect the taste of the coffee because you'll see that they highlight different aspects of each of the beans.
What temperature is that water and why is that important?
The water, well, it sort of depends on which coffee you're brewing, which temperature we're going to use, but temperature is going to be important because of the way that heat interacts with coffee and the way that can change the entire composition of your cup of coffee. So this is typically around 195 degrees. And the idea here, as you can see, we've got on this water tower that it's 210, which is okay for this one. If you use water that was too cool, it wouldn't access all the flavors of the coffee. If you use water that's too hot, it's going to scald it. So it's just sort of a balancing act.
Now, Peter, why is this all the rage, this process?
Well, I think that it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about getting all the flavor from the beans. We've talked about this with bread. We've talked about it with beer. It's all about extracting the full potential of flavor trapped in the ingredients, whether it's flour or grain or whatever. In this case, it's coffee beans. And what's happening is that people who brew at home and most coffee houses are still leaving a little bit of money on the table or leaving flavor, you know, behind when they're doing it imprecisely. So baristas have started to discover that there's ways to get an even better cup of coffee.
And the time it took to have this conversation, she has made the coffee and she's pouring it into a paper cup, which to me is a tragedy. But
some people do have to go, though.
The trouble with the world today is coffee in a cardboard cup. I believe that's a Candor and Ebb song, but don't hold me to it. So the end user, the coffee drinker, what will they experience that they couldn't have experienced had I gone to, oh, I don't know, Starbucks?
Oh, the S word. Well, it sort of depends on the coffee that we're brewing. But for example, that one is going to be a brighter Ethiopian coffee. And with the brew method that we chose here, we're highlighting the fruity aspects of the coffee. We're giving it decent body.
Okay, well, let me ask the same question another way. If I had taken the same beans, ground the same way, and stuck it in my coffee maker at home, which is essentially a pour over, you pour the water in one side and it comes out coffee on the other, what would the taste difference be like?
This is going to taste a lot cleaner and a lot fresher, mostly because of the way the water is introduced to the grounds. What you're going to find with your coffee maker at home is that the temperature is going to be significantly lower, and so it's going to greatly affect the flavor and the taste. So this is going to taste very vibrant and very bright.
So if I wanted to do this at home, could I?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You'd need the equipment to do it, but it's not too difficult to do. This is going to be the biggest obstacle to doing at home. It's like gooseneck tea kettle because it restricts the flow so that I can figure out where the water is going to go at every interval. If you were to use a tea kettle at your house, it would go everywhere and not be ideal.
Kelsey, thanks for the coffee.
No problem. Enjoy.
Now, Kelsey knows, he seems to know everything about coffee. It's unbelievable.
And other stuff.
Yeah, and we have a question here from Chris on Facebook who says, please compare the difference between these coffee barista artisans and your average Starbucks or Caribou employee.
I think a huge part of it, yeah, and I never get into like bashing other businesses, but you know, Starbucks is one thing. But I think the big difference is we're putting a lot of emphasis on the skill of the barista as opposed to so many pieces of equipment that just do the job for the barista.
Well, they've done that. They're like McDonald's,
right?
They standardize what it is you get at a coffee shop.
So you can get a cup of coffee at Starbucks in Paris, and it's going to be the same drink as you get in Tokyo, or
right.
You know. And obviously, they've needed to standardize it. But the emphasis on baristas really becoming more and more skillful is you know what being a barista is all about.
Hence the name Artisan Coffee. Mm-hmm. But doesn't that put you in a particularly precarious position? Because if you get a really good barista in your shop, you don't want them to leave. You have to actually pay those people.
Right. That's an important part of our model is the idea of like, a barista being just like a summer job for a high school student, that's not what we're looking for. We're looking for people it's our career. You know, I'm a full-time barista as well as a business owner.
I remember when we did a show on cocktail culture and the same thing with bartenders. We call them mixologists now, but really our mixologist, Stefan, who was here, that they said, you know, I'm just a bartender. He says, but that's one of the things that people come in for is that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we see that with the baristas too. People like having...
We're daytime bartenders.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We've gone toward this corporate world in almost everything in America, including broadcasting. And I got into broadcasting before it had gone there. It used to be a cottage industry and where people were valued, and now it's not. And it seems to me that in areas like coffee, in the food, well, restaurants, we're going back in the opposite direction, which I think is very encouraging. Mm-hmm. How long has this pour-over method been used, and where did it come from? Because I've never seen it done before.
It's actually an old, primitive method of brewing coffee. I've never been to Ethiopia. I've traveled a bunch, but it's one place on my bucket list. But apparently you can get basically a pour-over. They might not be using a $70 Hario kettle, but they might be using a cup or something. But it's basically the idea of brewing a single cup of coffee. So before coffee makers, that's how coffee was made. And there were some shops out in Lake California during the 70s, I think, that used the Chemex because the Chemex was invented, I think, in the 40s. David, was in
the
40s?
Yeah, the 40s.
And there was the home version, the Melita, which people could do pour-overs at home. That's how I learned how to do it back in the 1970s. Right. So the method's been around, but as an art form and as introducing it, one of the reasons why it's not so often seen is because it takes longer. You can't just come in and pump a cup of coffee like you can at most places. And if you want it done right, you'll have it made for you.
And we're kind of pushing against the idea of this fast food culture. And I think that's what we're doing in coffee as well. And like the craft coffee scene, we're revisiting the idea of it's okay to stop your day for a few minutes to enjoy a good cup of coffee.
It's the slow
right.
coffee.
Yeah, the key word is craft. Yeah. That it's a craft. Just
hard
like
to rush craft.
Just like craft beer making and craft bread making, mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've had a national barista competition here, I believe. And, huh? And David, you've been involved in serving gourmet coffee in the coffee market in this region for 20 years. Have we – and we're beginning to develop this craft beer culture here. Are we beginning to have or do we have already a coffee culture?
As my friend James here knows, we're developing it, and we really want to develop a culture where people do appreciate. I was sitting at James's shop the other day and just watching. As a professional in the coffee world, I can appreciate just the level of training that his baristas have and just the technique that they apply to every single thing. Each movement is a training procedure, and you can watch them go through it, and it's a beautiful thing.
Well, it seems meticulous to me, I think the good thing about this from your point of view would be that people are not going to do this at home, at least not to the degree that you do it. I mean, she weighed out the coffee beans. She weighed out the water. She made sure the water was at precisely the right temperature for that bean. Mm-hmm. She took great pains in taking this gooseneck tea kettle, which really allows her to control the flow of water, the tempo and the where it goes, very carefully pouring it. I watched her do it very carefully,
right.
Pouring it over the beans. I mean, it's these people have drunk the Kool-Aid.
Yeah, we all have.
But, you know, speaking of this gooseneck kettle that she used to pour it so she could get the water exactly where she wanted it, would that same coffee that she had ground worked as well in this chemistry set thing? I don't know what you call this the glass model.
Right, and I remember she brewed you a cup of the Bloya Natural Sun-Dried from Counterculture. And what you're going to find is that the cup of coffee you drank, it would work just as fine in the siphon pot. It would just be a very different cup of coffee. The body, the mouth feel. I find that using the siphon pot, you get like a almost velvety mouth feel, whereas the V60 is going to be really clean and crisp.
So do your customers who are really coffee aficionados come in and say, I want that coffee, but I want it brewed this way, or do you suggest the way, or just do it upon yourself?
Yeah, a little bit of both. I'm using the V60 as our main brewing method, but now that's a cool part about being part of that developing culture, like David said, here in Charlotte, is that now, even in the year and a half we've been open, or 2 years, we're seeing customers coming back in that had just seen pour-overs for the first time, and now they're asking for coffee brewed on the Chemex or brewed in the AeroPress, huh. And we're trying to develop that part of our business more.
And so and with the siphon pot, I just kept feeling, we're not in Kansas anymore. This is like a whole new world of coffee.
Although I think Andy M would have used that in the case.
Yes.
You can buy it at Sur La Table.
Or the Wizard of Oz, for sure.
Over the weekend. Dave on Facebook writes, please ask about AeroPress coffee. We've made it for 5 years now, and it has spoiled us for anything else except the occasional perfect espresso.
What does AeroPress mean?
Oh, that's it. You got one.
This is the AeroPress right here.
It looks like a cylinder. Well, it's a cylinder that you. I get. What do you?
Yeah, it's not the sexiest looking coffee.
It's plastic.
It looks like an
plunger.
Experiment.
Yeah. Is it like a French press?
Well, no. It's more like you're making a very small concentrated amount of coffee, and it's using the force of the plunger to extract. So you're.
So how is that different from French press?
Well, the French press, the part you're plunging down is just a filter, uh-huh. To remove. I mean, there is some agitation going on with the grounds, but this is actually, it's quicker than a French press because it's similar to what's going on in espresso when you have that,
high
that pressure.
It's high water. Pressure. Yeah.
And it's a finer grind. And I love the AeroPress. We've been doing it on ice, and it makes a great cup of coffee.
So what do? You put the coffee in the where does the coffee go?
Here. So the coffee.
This looks like a syringe.
Right.
A big flat syringe.
A giant syringe.
Yeah.
And here, let's see here. So we've got these little paper filters, and they sit right over here.
Okay.
You rinse it out, get any paper taste out.
So you put the coffee there?
Right, locks in. Mm-hmm. The coffee, and there's different ways of doing it. Some people do it like a reverse AeroPress, but the coffee goes in here with the water, and then after you've timed it, you're just going to sit it right on top of a cup or above a cup and just
push it through.
So it's extracting it under pressure.
It comes out into the cup.
Mm-hmm. All right. More coffee facts and more questions from you. And we're going to take a little roasting adventure in a moment or two as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
And you're listening to an archived version of Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio. With support this morning comes from WFAE members and Donald Hack Diamonds, serving Charlotte for over 30 years. Shoppers can experience the difference this holiday season. Donald Hack Diamonds, located at Sharon Road, across from South Park Mall, donaldhack.com. And the Harvey B. Gantz Center Jazzy Holiday Luncheon, honoring community arts patrons Sally and Russell Robinson, musician Tyrone Jefferson, and the Compass Group, December 6th, Westin Hotel, GantzCenter.org. Coming up on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock for Two Generations, chemical companies in Toms River, New Jersey, dumped toxic waste. And for this month's Environmental Outlook, Diane and her guest discuss the life of a small town ravaged by industrial pollution. That's Diane Rehm at 10 o'clock.
This is Christopher Kimball from America's Test Kitchen. This week on our show, I interview Langdon Cook. He's author of The Mushroom Hunters. He uncovers a world of mountain men who go deep into the woods to make their fortune using secrecy, hard work, and a sharp eye to outwit their competitors. I also learn a whole new way to make beef stew, and I taste test fresh goat cheese. Join us this week for America's Test Kitchen from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Listen on Sunday starting at 3 at 90.7 WFAE.
Slow down this thing for a second because we're too caffeinated to speak.
I love coffee, I love tea. I love the job I drive and it loves me. Coffee and tea and the job and me. A cup, a cup, a cup, a cup, a cup.
Yeah, Manhattan Transfer. We have their doodles on the wall here from when they were guests on the program. They doodle like mad. Let's see here. Funky Geezer on Facebook says, I've been a coffeeholic my life. I was delighted to find the many gourmet coffee selections at the Smelly Cat Coffee House in Noda. Here in Charlotte, Americana is my favorite this week. Do you know about that blend? Do you have any idea what that is?
If it's a Smelly Cat blend, I'm not familiar with it, but an Americano is an adaptation of what the GIs were drinking in Italy during World War II. It was they found the coffee in Italy too strong, so the Italians added water and called it an Americano. Somewhat derogatorily.
And I had that in Italy and hated it.
Yeah.
Americano.
It's just watered-down espresso, essentially.
Yeah. David on Facebook says, the perfect cup of coffee is Yemeni Mocha Matari from Yemen, made in a French Melior.
Wow.
Are we familiar with that?
He's taking his coffee seriously.
He does, absolutely.
I haven't heard of that.
Pete emails, can you ask your guest to describe cold press coffee, and is it available in Charlotte?
Actually, Central Coffee off of Central Boulevard or Central Avenue, they have a cold brewed coffee, and we're working on a recipe ourselves to start doing it.
How do you do that? How do you cold brew it?
So it's basically a longer extraction process where the coffee is sitting in room temperature water as opposed to hot water, because the temperature of the water is, you know, hot water extracts much faster. Mm-hmm. So it's sitting in cold water and it will literally brew over a period of maybe 15 to 20 hours. So it's slowly extracting. It's going to be a much more mellow, thick-bodied, chocolatey type of coffee.
Wow.
Used to make that a lot many years ago. And in fact, in my first restaurant, I served it that way. I made it ahead of time and just added the hot water to order. It seems like it does filter out a lot of the harsh or overly acidic tones.
The acidity level is minimal. It's pretty much
in some ways it's almost too much. It almost rounded it out to where it lost some of the edge that I liked.
Okay. And it's really durable. It's really a smooth flavor profile, so you can mix it with anything. So a flavored iced latte, if you wanted to call it that, or you know, mix it with milk, or just add water.
It sounds like the coffee flavor that you would get in coffee ice cream.
Yes, kind of like that.
Okay. Which I love, by the way. Coffee ice cream is the best. Jay Scott on Facebook. I buy cheap whole beans at a warehouse club, but I grind my own every morning and, most importantly, use enough grounds to keep the bitterness at bay. I drink it black and at this point in the morning have polished off my first pot.
Wow.
Talk about the beans that you might find at Sam's Club or Costco. I know that you do a blend for Sam's Club.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, we have.
Is that unusual, or is that something that they do all over the country?
They wanted. Well, I'm not sure if they do it in other areas of the country. They came to us and asked for a regional partnership, so we could have some more local roasted coffee in their stores. And it turns out that it's developed quite a following. They, we're in 5 Sam's stores now, and getting ready to pick up 3 others.
Mm-hmm. You know, didn't you say earlier that just having roasting your own beans and having a freshly made cup from freshly ground beans in itself, regardless of whether it's the best beans in the world or not, still is going to give you a great experience.
Absolutely. And that's one of the wonderful things about the coffee that we're selling to Sam's Clubs is it's fresh. I mean, we're roasting it to order. We're delivering it, you know, within 3 or 4 days of when they order it. And the customers who are buying it, we have active demo people from, you know, that we hired to put out there to demonstrate and sample the coffee out. They taste it and they say, oh, and here it is right here. We could grind it for you as well. So they do get that experience. It's a freshness window, and it's a, you know, it's a freshly ground. If they grind it there at the store, they could take it home and brew
that's
it themselves.
The best thing about those big club stores. I go there on Saturday and have lunch. just on the samples.
Their food court's amazing.
Best hot dog deal in town.
Not the food court, just the samples. That's it.
Oh, the samples.
That's it. You are into the roasting side of this business, David Haddock, and you roast beans from all over the world, and it's not unlike wine. Where the grape has been grown affects the flavor of the wine, whether it's a Cabernet, whatever the blend happens to be. What's the more important, where it comes from, how you roast it, how you brew it?
All three.
Thanks, David.
Sorry for no controversy, but yeah. No, when we travel to these various countries, we're walking all over the farms and we're seeing how the coffee is being grown, the habitat that it's being grown in. That's an important factor. It directly affects the flavor of the coffee, as many other variables do. I think the second most important thing is how it's roasted. Who the artisan is that's actually conducting the roasting, how he applies the science and the artisanship and his experience to knowing the personality of each individual bean. You can do exactly the same thing to one bean that you did on one before it that had a great success and completely ruin it. The same thing with the brewing process. You know, how it's presented in the cup is a critical factor.
Again, Peter and I took a little field trip last week to Noda and David Haddock's lab. It's a lab now. It's not just a place. It's a lab for a further explanation on this roasting process. So David has brought both Peter and I to Boqueta Boutique Coffee Roasters, I suppose, on North Davidson. And we're going to make several cups of coffee from the very beginning of the process. You're taking some very pale beans. You have a whole little bag of very pale beans. What are these?
They're just the raw green beans that we import from various countries around the world.
And what is this bag?
What we have in there right now is a Colombia Suprema, one of the touchstones of the Juan Valdez Empire, as it were.
So we're going to pour those beans into the hopper of the roaster, and they will fall into the roaster, and they'll be in there for how long?
Anywhere between 13 to 17 minutes, depending on the type of bean. It's going to have its own personality and its own way that it wants to be roasted.
And the roaster is actually turning these beans over and over and over and over. What's the heat source?
It's natural gas.
So it's blowing hot air, or it's actually roasting over the so-called coals of natural gas?
If you'd imagine your home barbecue grill and the infrared burners that they now put on those, that's what's in that particular roaster. So the flame is spread out very evenly underneath the cylinder that's containing the coffee.
And it depends on what kind of bean it is as to how long it's in there. What about the temperature?
Well, the temperature is going to vary depending on how much moisture in the bean there is. The first thing that leaves the bean is water content, so it's kind of evaporating. The second thing that happens is flavor is profiled and generated. And the last thing that happens is simple caramelization of sugar.
So, David, this process takes about 15 minutes, and every once in a while, you pull a little handle on this machine and pull out a little sampling of coffee beans. What are you looking for?
The progression of color. And the smell, what's happening as the water evaporates and as the flavor is developed. 20 years ago when I started doing this, all we really had to go by was just an imagination and a temperature gauge. What we use here in the lab, though, is a piece of technology that logs every 15 seconds of data that is happening inside the roaster, whether it be fuel control, airflow, and just general bean mass temperature. So on the screen, we have the evaporation of water, up to a point about 270 degrees, the development of flavor, here where we dwell it a bit, and then caramelization of sugar. And you hear this cracking going on right now. That's the first crack of the bean. as coffee beans roast, they swell. Gases start to develop on the inside. The membranes of the cell start to break. The chaff, the left little piece of silver skin that's left, starts to break. And what that cracking is, it's just that bean expanding.
Very mild popcorn is what it, what it exactly. sounds like.
So now I'll take a look at it again. And at first crack, you're starting to see a chocolate style of color, you know, past cinnamon, but more chocolate.
And this is the first time when you've pulled it out, A, that it's darker, like, because it came in very white, almost whitish green, and now it's beginning to develop that brown, but also the first time you pulled this out that I've smelled what smells like coffee.
And the artistry of coffee roasting is usually based on sight, smell, and sound. You know, we know what temperature these beans typically crack at. And we know what they smell like when they get to this point. And we're looking what kind of at the kind of smoke that it's generating. And then just by sight, we're looking for, in this Colombian, I'm looking for, a Rolo type of chocolate, Hershey bar type of chocolate color. The cracking has stopped. We're in between first crack and second crack. When second crack comes along, you're not addicted. It's too dark, okay, for this particular coffee. So we're going to stop it here in just a second.
That was the sound of the coffee coming out of the roaster into the hopper, and what went in as a whitish green has now looks like a coffee bean. What it doesn't have, David, and I've always heard that you look for this, maybe I was wrong, it doesn't have that oily sheen on it. It looks like a dry bean. What does that mean?
For this particular coffee, it means that it's roasted to a specific level before the oils will rise to the surface. If we let this coffee stay in, say, another 30 to 45 seconds, you would have exactly that, a nice oily sheen.
Is that a bad thing?
It's not necessarily a bad thing. We don't like to take it so it's wet looking. Okay. When we do a French roast, we see a dot of oil when we pull the dryer out, and then we dump it because we know it's going to carry over just a little bit. So it's going to continue the cooking or heating process, and it'll take it up to where it just develops almost like a bronzish kind of sheen to it.
So now that you've taken it out of the roaster and it's in this little hopper and you're stirring it around a little bit, are you letting it cool or could you grind this and make a cup of coffee out of it right now?
Well, right now the beans are coming down off of about 400 degrees. Okay, it's cooled a bit. So we wouldn't want to brew it right at this moment, but in about 5 to 6 minutes, we could certainly grind it and brew it and taste it.
Oh, and that's the end of it. Okay, well, we're sitting here drinking all kinds of things while that is going on. You're a small roaster, David. Does it make a difference to somebody who is a coffee lover? Does it impact, does the size of the roastery, if that's the right word, make a difference in terms of the quality?
It is the amount of attention that we pay to exactly what's happening to the bean. For example, there's a large coffee operation or roasting operation up the road here.
We went there.
That will do hundreds of thousands of pounds of coffee, you know, every week.
Right.
Just blowing through it. And they have to do it quickly. And they have to do it, in a specific way that has the broadest appeal to the widest audience.
But not with computers, because even your operation is controlled by computers. It tells you exactly the temperature and how long it's been in and all this other, the moisture content. And can't they duplicate that on a mass level if they just program the computer right?
They can, but would they?
Okay.
There's not enough. I mean, the coffee that we source is unique. We have one that was never sold in the United States before. We want to treat that coffee in a specific way, and each individual bean has to be roasted in an individual way.
And how do you find out? How do you know the right way to do it?
I was taught by Fred Houck, the founder of Counterculture, a long time ago, and got the techniques down. And then as technology has progressed, it's given us tools that we can actually see what we're doing, like you saw the other day at the roastery.
Let me share some things that have come in from listeners. Jim in Charlotte emails, what about those of us who aren't coffee snobs, hipsters, celebrities, or baristas? What advice can you offer to those of us who want to make a good enough cuppa with Mr. Coffee?
Nice. Well, you don't have to be a hipster or a coffee snob to enjoy good coffee. So we got a lot of both. But, just start with really good fresh beans and you can brew a good cup of coffee on a Mr. Coffee.
Yeah.
It might not isolate the flavors like you could get from a manual brew method, but you can still get a great cup of coffee.
Do you have a favorite coffee maker, a consumer level coffee maker that you think is particularly good at doing what it does?
Actually, the one that you mentioned you had is a great one.
The Mocha Master.
The Mocha Master. is a fantastic coffee maker.
Is that because it heats the water to a hotter level?
Yep, it's one of the few like home coffee makers that the water levels at a right level. I mean, the heat levels right, and then it also the way it pours the water over. It's almost like a shower head, right? Yeah. So it sort of like evenly saturates, as opposed to where it just kind of pockets, you know, wet pockets.
And it allegedly heats the temperature of the water to 195 mm-hmm. to 200 degrees.
It does.
Allegedly.
There you go.
We'll see.
need a thermopen to check.
JJ tweets, "I love an iced Japanese style pour over from Not Just Coffee."
I know, JJ.
There you go. Larry in Pineville, what about all that added cream and sugar? Years ago, I weaned myself away from it. Black is beautiful.
It is.
If you want the nuances, again, mm-hmm. the subtleties, then you know, then the milk is a buffer and the sugar is a flavor enhancer, and it's great to for less quality coffees. But you may not need them. In fact, new products like teas made from the skins of coffees, the cherries.
We've been drinking
Cascara
Seca.
Cascara Seca, yeah.
And this is the husk of the coffee bean? Is that what this is? What is this?
The fruit and the skin of the coffee cherry.
And it tastes not unlike tea with a hint of sugar. And there's no sugar in this. This is strictly brewed. But how did you brew this?
We used a French press this morning. Just added 200-degree water to the dried skins and let it sit there for now. It's been about an hour.
It's like tea. It's brewing tea.
It's delicious.
And it's kind of tea made from coffee cherries.
Yeah. Yes. It's almost got a squeeze of lemon in it.
And again, the sweetness is there. So we don't need to add any enhancements to it.
Jonathan and Charlotte wants to know about the over-roasting of beans and how to avoid it. Some big-name coffee shops have this problem.
I think there's definitely a movement, and David would know more about the roasting side, but there's definitely a movement towards lighter roasted coffees, and those are 100% my preference. We use counterculture, and we don't use any dark roasted coffees.
If you are a lover of the name brand coffees that have been around forever, will you necessarily appreciate what we've been talking about today?
You should.
Sure.
And any suggestion on what type of coffee someone should try that they haven't had before?
Something from Ida Batier, maybe.
Definitely that.
We've got some of that at the shop right now.
Well, drink up, because I hear the percolator in the background. James Yoder, owner and founder of Not Just Coffee. David Haddock, director of coffee for Buckhead and Mountain Coffee Roasters. Peter Reinhardt, chef on assignment at Johnson & Wales University. This program guaranteed to be good to the last drop.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7.